Redwood Soundwave.
We really stooped to an all-time low on this one, Bombay.
I'm insulted by that, Frank. You have no idea how low I can stoop.
Gordon, you need a break. You're too wrapped up in your work. The community service will do you good. It'll teach you compassion, a sense of fair play, how to fit in.
You remember, I used to play on the ponds that left the dock until your father called you back. But you really flew on that ice, Gordon. It's not about winning, Gordon. It never was. Just show them how to play. Show them how to have fun. Teach them to fly.
The ducks? Were the ducks?
The duck is one of the most noble, agile, and intelligent creatures of the animal kingdom.
But they're wimpy. They don't even have teeth.
Neither do hockey players. Have you guys ever seen a flock of ducks flying in perfect formation? Pretty awesome the way they all stick together. Ducks never say die. Ever seen a duck fight? No way. Why? They know that if they mess with one duck, they gotta deal with the whole flock. I'm proud to be a duck.
Oh, man.
I'd be proud to fly with any one of you. So how about it? Who's a duck? I'll be a duck. Quack. Quack.
Quack.
Quack.
Quack.
The reel is finished. The house lights are up. It's time to examine the Mighty Ducks as the final part of our ongoing series on child labor. This is Fields of Glory, and I'm Biggs.
And I am Aaron. And Biggs, once again, I'm going to say, this movie was work. This movie was work. I was hoping when I put it on, we said we needed some jams. We needed some good movies. That was one of the reasons that we let a movie go and pulled this one onto our roster at the last minute. Folks can listen to that draft episode. I remember loving this movie as a kid, and I was expecting it to not age as well as I wanted it to. But I don't know, man. I didn't really find much in this movie. I have a lot to say about like the standpoint, the thematic, and the excitement and all of that. But like as soon as the movie started, I was like, okay, this is grim.
All right, Gordon, it's up to you. I don't want to see any goats around here after the game. You got it? Now, you missed this shot. You're not just letting me down, you're letting your whole team down, too.
And then it was like the lawyer stuff.
This man put his neck on the line for your greed.
Objection, Your Honor.
Will both counselors approach the bench?
What are you doing? Get out there and be my lawyer.
Please restrict yourself to relevant cross-examination.
Your Honor, the applicability of societal intent vis-a-vis individual action is well established. I'm citing Minneapolis v. Higgins. Which the appellate court overruled the judge.
My son left after, like, I think I told you, like, 8 minutes. I saw an interview with Emilio Estevez, and he was like, I wanted to make a movie that my kids would watch from start to finish. And I'm like, well, my kid's gone. So, anyway, I don't know. This was work for me. I didn't enjoy this as much as I wanted to. What's your take? What's your reaction?
Well, let me ask you a question real quick. Did you watch this when you were younger, and did you like it?
When I was, I think I was, like, 12. Yeah, 92 is when this came out, and I was 12. And, yeah, I think that I was swept up in the Mighty Ducks frenzy there. I think, I mean, I don't know that I was like a huge hockey fan. I've never really been a big hockey fan. I remember liking this movie as a kid, and that was part of why I wanted to watch it. My buddy Jason said that it was really formative for him, and a bunch of other people have said the same thing. It really hit a generation in the face. Yeah.
Our age group and younger, for sure. So I didn't ever watch this movie before a couple of days ago. I explained this in Cool Runnings. I was not a fan of Disney at that age.
Huh.
And so I avoided the crap out of all of them. Some of the animation I had to see anyway, just because being at people's houses, my younger stepbrother playing them all the time.
Right.
This was one I adamantly was not going to watch. And as I got older and started caring about things like selling out, I hated it even more having not seen it because they bought out that hockey team, which we're going to talk about later.
Uh-huh.
And just on and on and on down the line, I just could not stand Mighty Ducks having never seen it. And then I sat down to watch it and ready to just be snarky and hate it. And I really liked it.
Well, this is great. This is great because we are coming in from opposite sides on this. And tell me why, Biggs. What did you like about it?
It wasn't as ham-handed candid as I thought it was going to be.
Okay.
Like, there was certain things that I've seen redone over and over again that are taking from Mighty Ducks, which in turn is slightly massaging it from the Bad News Bears, which we'll probably have to cover someday.
Yeah.
Everything I thought was going to be annoying and just did not look forward to, they handled it better than I thought they would. For example, Emilio Estevez is just a terrible person at the beginning, right? And
yes, he is.
Typically with these movies, it's about, I'm going to say at some point in the second act, like usually towards the end of the second act, they have an epiphany, and then that helps kick off the third act when they're better. They resolve all of this by the end of the first act. And,
yeah,
you know, it's like a half hour.
You look great out there, Gordy. Come on, let's go inside, huh? It's getting late.
A few more minutes.
Go on, get out
of here. Thanks.
Hi.
Please just go away. Charlie doesn't want to be on the team anymore, and neither he nor I have anything to say to you.
Well, I have something to say to you. I came to apologize to Charlie, to both of you.
What?
Apologize.
Well, you should.
And I'm like, oh, like watching a kid's movie is a strike against it. And then watching an unlikable protagonist is a strike against it.
Uh-huh.
They did away with that so fast. I was like, okay. And then there was just all sorts of other little things where I found myself laughing and I didn't think I would laugh. Like, I felt like for the most part, it was a pretty well-made movie. Now, there's loads of problems we're going to talk about because that's our job.
Right.
But I would be lying if I said I didn't sit there and feel entertained for 90 minutes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I appreciate it. And I think it's going to be fun to pick through because it definitely was a generational movie. The sequels, you know, happened and weren't as big, but when it came out, it was big. And as we are going to discuss, apparently helped put the city of Anaheim, California on the map, along with a baseball team. At the end, we're going to look at Viridiana Lieberman's book again, Sports Heroines on Film. This book is going to come off the shelf again and again and again. I'm really pumped. It's got some fun things to note about this movie. I've also got a Jeff Ostrove article, Disney Synergy. Don't we love that word? Disney Synergy in Anaheim, California, the political economy of the Mighty Ducks. One more touch. This is a book chapter. It's chapter 3, Survival of the Fattest, Contending with the Fat Boy in Children's Ensemble Films by Jerry Mosher. This is one of several movies that plays into generational anti-fatness in very, very specific ways. I think we get a whole decade or two of children's movies. Book chapter points out this is an, like, anti-fatness is old in entertainment. It goes way back for sure.
Yeah.
It's not new in this era.
Remember when we were talking about Fatty Arbuckle?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. 1915 is when we were having the movie. Yeah, it was from that moment there. But the point that, you know, this movie is making, and this is in the book, Where the Boys Are, Cinemas of Masculinity and Youth 2005. It just makes the point that we get this kind of staple again and again and again, particularly in kids' movies, which is where it can do a whole lot of harm.
Yeah.
So we'll revisit that at the end. Just a lot of, in any case, whether I like the movie or not is kind of incidental, as we will see when we go. The point is to look at how it's made and what it does. And this was a good cut. I got a whole bunch of fun, you know, theory to talk about at the end. So maybe we should get to the tale of the tape.
Gordon Bombay is a child, lost his father and missed a penalty shot to win the game in his Pee Wee Hockey League. Jack Riley, his coach, berates him. He grows up to be a defensive attorney and goes out drinking to celebrate a victory.
A defensive attorney with very offensive behavior in the courtroom is what we get. He yeah. plays by little tweaks in the rules to win at all costs, which is the legacy that was instilled in him by his hockey coach.
And this is the period where we're really going after lawyers and pop culture.
I mean,
not that they kind of don't deserve it, but they were really, really just getting a sledgehammer to the back of the head at this point.
Very convenient foil. Yeah.
Yeah. He gets a DUI and has to do community service coaching a peewee hockey team. He is standoffish to his players and has his limo driven onto a pond where they practice.
Is that smart? I know that it's probably not that deep. Like, they're probably just on like two feet of water or something like that, but just probably shouldn't. He's like, I grew up on the ice. I know. And I just want to just bloosh right in the water.
Yeah, it's okay because he knows.
I'm Gordon Bombay, the new hockey coach.
They send you over here to coach the team and you endanger their lives.
What danger? Look, I grew up on the ice. I know when it's safe to drive on.
How do you know?
I just know, all right?
I also can't get over the fact that his driver is one of the convicts from Con Air. I just can't unsee it.
Put this thing down.
Listen here, Big Daddy. We got zero fuel and we're dropping too fast. Strip's where I'm gonna land. Only the word is crash.
It's just like, is he also doing community service? What's going on?
One of the players' mothers berates him. Then, without holding so much as a practice, he loses to his former team, the Hawks, 17-0. In the next match, he tries to get the players to draw penalties and fails to convince Charlie Conway to fake an injury like Riley taught him.
Once again, winning at all costs with a bunch of shady tactics, and this time it doesn't work.
They lose and he visits his mentor, Hans, who helps him remember when he loved playing. Gordon goes to Charlie's home and apologizes to him and his mother. He convinces his boss to sponsor the team. He renames them the Ducks and gets them brand new equipment.
The uni moment, the point where they get their uni. If you go over to the Real War Project with Charles and I, we have a lot of conversations, particularly in the episode about glory, but also several others about what it means to get the official uniform and how that makes the soldier. And in sports movies, I think we talked about it in Cool Runnings and a couple of other moments too, where the uni makes the player. It's like, you look good, you play good. It's a big moment in this movie too, and I think kids everywhere were jealous of the uni, and this is where I'll point out that it was the top-selling NHL jersey as soon as it came out because a bunch of non-hockey players wanted it.
It was so popular that Aaron Donaldson went to University of Oregon to be a Duck.
Sco Ducks!
Gordon recruits a female figure skater named Tammy Duncan and her brother Tommy and an enforcer and power hitter Fulton Reed. He also takes Charlie under his wing and snuggles up to his mother. He realizes that the Hawks star Adam Banks should play for the Ducks because of redistricting.
Poaching!
He also gets in an argument with Riley, telling him sarcastically that the Ducks are a bunch of losers. The Ducks overhear the discussion and forfeit the next game. Gordon's boss tells him that if he doesn't let Adam play for the Hawks, he'll be fired. Gordon refuses. Then he explains sarcasm to the Ducks and they go on a run. Adam decides to play for their team since he has no choice if he wants to play hockey, but his teammates don't accept him. The Ducks fire off a run and get to the championship game against the Hawks. Riley has his players injure Adam and trip Charlie. The Ducks rally back and tie the game. With no time left on the clock, the Ducks get a penalty shot. Gordon can choose anyone and he selects Charlie, telling him he believes in him and it'll be okay if he makes a shot or not. Charlie does a triple deke and wins the game. Later, Gordon boards a bus to try out for a minor league hockey team. The Ducks wish him luck and he lets them know that no matter what, he'll return to help them defend their title.
There are several moments where children are getting injured in this movie. There's definitely a moment where a kid looks very concussed coming off the ice. And they literally just like dump him on the bench and then everyone's attention just turns right back to the field.
Get him on the bench, Charlie. Okay. Okay, Ducks. We still got a chance here.
And thinking about the rhetoric of ableism book here, which is by Cherney, I think, where he talks about the sports culture itself is intrinsically ableist because it literally just trucks this away and acts like it never happened. And in this case, it is a child with a look on his face that suggests some kind of neural damage or trauma or confusion at the very least. And then here at the end, we have this like, go hurt those children moment from the other coach. Dang.
The lesson of being a bad sport as a coach wasn't enough. Then you have to have him try to injure people.
Riley is like deliciously bad in this movie, right? Isn't he just the perfect evil villain? I noticed when we were watching this, and I'm curious, this might be late, better off in the Batch episode. Black Stallion doesn't really have a villain in any capacity. I couldn't, like, nature is scary.
That's why I went with the garbage can guy. Like, who else is I going to pick, you know? I guess the guys who are hurting a horse at the beginning.
Anyone at all hurting a horse. We don't like them because Black Stallion tells us not to do that. This movie has a clear villain. He's good at being villainous. This is a movie that everyone loved that tells children that part of playing sports is that you could get concussed and or hurt on purpose by the other coach. And that's just part of playing ball, kids. Like, I know that there are listeners out there that are like, well, yeah, that is part of playing ball. But again, part of what we're here to do is unpack the expectations that we drill into the minds of children. And while Gordon Bombay is not saying win at all costs, he is definitely just like shoveling kids off the ice once they're hurt and saying put more kids out there to try to win. And that's kind of the same thing, isn't it?
It's also interesting to me that Lane Smith, who's playing Riley, has a slight Southern accent and Emilio Estevez does not, because Estevez is the lawyer and you expect him to be like, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I might be a simple Southern lawyer, but I do know one thing.
That would be awesome. We know he has the range, Biggs. We know he could do it. But instead, he goes for stand-up sleazeball lawyer, I guess is how I would describe him. Does he have a redeeming moment?
Are you talking about Emilio Estevez?
Yeah, one of the things I noticed this time around that to me made it really hard to enjoy this movie is that this guy is a lawyer and a drunk driver. He's named Gordon Bombay because his drinking was supposed to be a bigger part of the story there, and they apparently cut that out. And all he does is basically realize that he was traumatized once in a hockey game because his coach is terrible and he missed a shot, and maybe that mindset isn't good for him. And that's it. What am I missing? Did I miss a major moment?
So he breaks the cycle of abuse, right? Like his coach abused him in a certain way and making it out.
Okay.
And so he does do that for the kid. And then he also gets some equipment, which I don't think is something any other coach would have figured out at District 5, apparently, because District 5 is just like, you just get drafted into service for coaching this hockey team, right?
So his redemption is to not be an abuser and to be well connected with a lawyer that can give him $15,000.
No, I don't think it's a redemption.
Right. Okay.
I'm just saying, like, he breaks a cycle of abuse, but the way that he kind of pays it forward with the kid, it's redemptive for himself, I guess, but it's not really redemption unto other people. It's just,
right?
Like, this is a personal growth thing for him, right? Like, he is the main character. The kids are incidental to the story. He is the main character. So it is a story of personal growth, I think.
And it feels like a really shallow audience pool. It's like, hey, dudes out there that had a bad time in sports and maybe might be abusers, don't be an abuser. You don't got to do that. And that's the audience for the protagonist. Other people can see themselves in the movie. They want it to be a kid's movie that kids can go and see. But in my mind, I'm like, we have this crappy white guy who's got everything going for him. And at the end, we feel a little bit better about him. I don't know. I just don't get a lot out of the movie. And the whole time I'm looking for more, I'm like, maybe there's a better story with these kids. Maybe some of them have arcs, but they're all kind of stereotypes. Callum did come back in and ask me this question, which I want to ask you. Is Hans Santa? Yes or no? Because it feels a little like Santa, and it could just be because we're recording this around the holiday season, but he seems like this workshop far away somewhere, and he goes and doesn't quite sit on his lap, but he does basically say, what do I do?
Yep, gives him the gift of sharpened skates and a renewed love of hockey.
Gordon?
How did you know?
Through the back door this time of night, just like you used to.
And that's another thing that could have been super annoying with that guy. But you get the warmth from him and he's kind of in and out in two scenes. And I'm just like, okay, like we didn't have to belabor the point. We don't have to hear him in voiceover. Like when Emilio Estevez is going to make a wrong decision and have him be like, just remember when you love the game.
Just show them how to play. Show them how to have fun.
And then, like, go back over and you know what I mean? Like,
instead, we just get him scowling and shaking his head, and the audience goes, who is that? And the movie's like, funny, you should ask. And there we go.
It's a surrogate father, right?
I mean, apparently so, right? I just felt like this time around, the first time I saw this movie, I was, like, too young to really care much about Gordon. And so I think I was just like, oh, this is a, like, kind of fun, adventurous, misfits kids movie, and they're going to play hockey, and they shouldn't win, but they will. It's an underdog story, and everybody likes those for kids, right? Like, great.
And they've literally remade this movie so many times.
Right.
Not just the sequels, but I mean, sometimes you throw Keanu Reeves into the lead, you know?
It would be interesting to cross-cut this with Major League, because, like, I think you see similar turns in the story. I mean, even the owner is villainous and potentially not who we want to cheer for. I don't know.
You know what this is? This is one part Major League, one part Bad News Bears. We're really going to have to do Bad News Bears, I think. I'm realizing how influential that movie is as we're talking here, but
it's an important one.
It is a stew of a couple of sports movies put together. You even get Rocky too, because there's this, even though it's exactly what I was saying with Rocky, Hollywood taking the wrong lesson from Rocky.
Yeah.
They are reframing it as they make the championship, like they're just going to work hard. Like whether you make it or not, it doesn't matter as long as you take the shot, right? Like these are all the kinds of things you get from Rocky, but they get to win at the end because Hollywood learns that lesson incorrectly, as do the Rocky sequels. quite frankly.
Right. It's interesting that he recruits so many different people to the team, but he doesn't really develop much of a relationship with any of those people.
Just the power hitter kid, right?
Just that one kid, right? And it's really just to teach him how to skate.
Like, well, it's a little bit more because it's also like the kid gives him a toughness that they didn't have.
Yeah.
And he gives them a legitimate scoring threat that they didn't have, which, of course, they then double down on that when they get the kid from the Hawks. Other than Charlie, they spend the most time with that kid, I think. We even see him menacing in the background before he actually becomes part of the team.
And I get that it's like he starts like literally in the alleys and the streets and this like brooding bull. And
dude,
he
I
ends
love
up
this
in
kid,
this.
Man.
I know, right? Isn't he great? He's not a bully. I like that they don't make him a bully. They just make him this like big brooding outsider. That's pretty cool. And I get that they're they're taking him from quote the streets and they're putting him in this nice uniform and making him part of a team. And he's a winner and he follows the rules. And so that is the turn that the movie is saying this is what he's doing for him. The only way he mentors any of the kids is by dating Charlie's mom. Someone on Letterboxd was like, why does this kid want the coach to date his mom so much? Like, that was weird. And I don't know that there's mentoring there.
That is a kid's movie staple too. You connect with the kid and then you connect with the mom through the kid. Yeah. And it's another way of having a woman character in there and a romance story, but then also making sure she's always a mother no matter what. Like, she's still got to be a mother first.
And emphasizing she needs a husband. She needs a husband.
But I will say in that regard, it could be worse in that I was watching really carefully in the kissing scene. And she literally states the things that she wants from him. And then he acknowledges them. And then he leans in. And then she leans in and finishes the kiss. I'm like, oh, good. And I know that's a little thing.
Sure.
But it's a really big thing in these movies, especially for kids. Because, like, we grew up with the forced kiss, right? Like, right off the top of my head, I'm thinking Han Solo with Princess Leia and Empire Strikes Back. But just copy and paste into a million movies.
There's a lot of them. And there's also a lot where she says no, she says no, she says no, she says no, she says no. And then she says yes. And this movie doesn't give us that either. That's not what we're doing here.
Yeah. Should we get into the thematic?
Let's.
Unrepentant criminal takes kids under wing.
What kind of DUI laws does this country have where we have someone operating a motor vehicle while intoxicated enough to be pulled over? And the solution is put him in charge of a kid's team. Let's do it. This sounds like a terrible idea. What's going on, Biggs?
It's so crazy. I have to say, like, honestly, I got community service when I was younger and I had to go work in dumps, dude.
Yeah.
It was nothing like this. I would have loved if they were like, all right, now you got to go coach a kid's hockey team. I'd be great. I have no idea how to coach hockey. That sounds a lot better than like carrying out people's boxes of scraps in the middle of winter.
Or going way out to the middle of I-90 and just picking up whatever you find for the next quarter mile.
Yeah, maybe that's partly because he is a defense attorney and he's in the system. Uh-huh. So they're like, let's throw him a softball. I guess they literally say that, don't they?
They do. There's several tiers of justice in this country, and they're pretty open about it in this movie. And one thing I know for a fact is you can get multiple DUIs and still continue to live a life that many people would say should not be yours, because that is dangerous. Drinking and operating a motor vehicle is incredibly dangerous. This movie kind of blows it off as a little bit of a no-no. For me, the thematic is basically just there's no I in team. Like, winning at all costs is bad. If you try to win at all costs, that will make you a spiteful person. It will make you a kind of sleazy person. It will definitely make you a successful person, but that success won't make you happy. And apparently what makes you happy is coaching hockey. I don't know.
And I want to say, Aaron, I was so taken back by this that I wrote down the quote, because we were talking in the Moneyball episode that we kicked off the season with, replaying it from a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. We were talking about how we did not understand the mindset of you get to a championship and then you just like throw away any accomplishments from that, because
it drives me nuts.
Yeah, it drives me crazy too. And they have the quote, at least you got to play in a championship game. Charlie says that to Emilio Estevez, right?
Yeah.
And sorry, Gordon. I guess I should get the character's name. But he says that, and it's like, yeah, that's actually something they're highlighting in this movie. And then they reinforce it. So that is a good lesson for kids. Like, there's plenty of bad, and we're going to get into more. But there are a few good things in this movie, I think. And that's one of them. And I wish more kids had taken that lesson from the Mighty Ducks, because they grew up to be adults our age that participate in this ring culture BS that I can't. cannot stand.
For reasons that will become evident later on, Biggs and I watched a documentary called Born to Play, and one of the players there said explicitly, "What's second place? That's nothing. That throws you back with all of the other people." And I'm just shaking my head, being like, "Dude, you have a broken understanding of sports, in my opinion."
Let's say why we were watching it.
We got an interview with the director, didn't we? Yes, we did.
Yes, we did. Who wrote a bunch of the material that you were saying you were going to reach out with in National Velvet. So I'm super stoked.
We're going to pick up the chapter. We're going to pick up the book, Sports Heroines on Film by Viridiana Lieberman. And she is an editor. They're a director. They do all sorts of other things that we're really pumped to talk to them about. So anyway, but the point was that you're right. That note, like playing in a championship game is a dream of a million children everywhere. And even to lose that is a profound and tremendous accomplishment. And if you cannot play with gratitude in your heart every single moment of every single play, because that's all of sports, is you are on the field and other people aren't, and they wish they were. Like, you have to play with that gratitude to be a champion, and this movie has some of that. It's cool. And this isn't a big touch for the standpoint, so I'll just kind of put it here. I have a masculinity stencil that I talked about with the Black Stallion, and the Black Stallion pinged 5, I said. This movie definitely has the gray area of unaccountability. This dude's a drunk driver and he gets to coach hockey. Like, what the hell's going on there? This has the idea that he's described by force and control, but the force element is simply the sport of hockey. It is not his coaching. His coaching is a rejection of the force element and is in fact like, go out, have a good time, like we're just here to play. And that, I think, is actually really important. The familial patriarchy, the occupational achievement, all of that stuff is here. Compulsory heterosexuality, kind of like you, it's like I see a much more consensual conversation here, as weird and contrived and shoehorned as it is.
Yes.
It's still the cishet white settler patriarch, but this is a softer touch on a lot of these tropes. And as far as like toxic masculinity goes, you could do a lot worse in a hockey movie. You could do a lot worse. It's a sport that opens itself up for like bash your teeth out. And they do. They make fun of the fact that hockey players don't have teeth. But like, this is a sport that would really embrace that. And partly because it's a Disney kids movie, but also I guess partly just because of the story. I don't know. It's like they didn't do that.
Yeah, I watched the exact opposite end of this movie a couple weeks ago, which was Goon.
Yeah.
Yes, there he is.
I don't have a thing, but you had your show, and my dad and my brother, they have their doctor thing. Everybody's got something with me.
Oh, he's going up in the stands.
See, it's over here.
Oh, Adam Boy, that's it. Dog!
Doug, you impressed the hell out of me last night. Come down to the ring for a tryout.
And whoa, what a difference.
This has all the elements of a sports masterpiece.
Ready?
Yes. Thank you for asking.
This is about to get ugly.
Yeah.
We might talk about that someday. I almost feel like it's one that'll come up. But we like to notice when they reference movies that we've already covered. And they had a Karate Kid reference in this.
They definitely did. And I'm glad that you picked this up, because they also had really overt references to SNL. They had one character who was basically just doing a bit from SNL again and again.
Yeah, Rob Schneider.
Tom! Tommy!
Hey, Richard, I'm just making some copies.
The Tomster! Tom Man! Tom Tom!
How you doing, Richard?
The Tomster, making copies! Mr. Tom! Tommy!
Yeah, see ya.
Tom!
Carpenter, you just had to stop the puck, Mr.
Carpellani. Bell Hooks says movies make culture. You can look at these moments in this movie and everything we're going to talk about here in a little bit and be like, ding, 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 ding. This is how this works. It's really fun to see those little moments blow by, but to realize that performatively and culturally, they're pretty significant.
Should we go to Sandpoint?
Yeah.
Minority accuses grandson of immigrant of dealing drugs. Pasty white screenwriter chuckles.
Ha 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 ha. My goodness. I wrote white male exceptionalism with a great big exclamation point because I feel like I said, that's about all that we get is, I mean, there's other standpoint touches. Explain your standpoint note to me. What's going on here?
The black kid who is just a black kid. I think he only gets like five lines. And I say that because like he's not treated as anything else in this movie.
We have the Oreo line. So there are at least two black kids on the team. Ugh. Yeah. And they do this line again and again and again.
Gross.
See also white male exceptionalism. I know.
So when he drives a limo up and he comes out, they think he's dealing drugs. And so that kid keeps saying he's dealing drugs. And I thought Emilio Estevez, I did not know his nationality.
Yeah.
And so I looked it up and found out he's like a third generation immigrant because Martin Sheen, formerly Estevez, had a Spanish father and an Irish mother. So there you go.
There's an interesting interview that I watched with him that's fairly recent where he talks about his grandfather looking at Martin Sheen on a movie marquee and just hanging his head in disappointment and how Martin Sheen told him that story. And that's part of why he kept the name Estevez. And a lot of people in the studio while they were telling that story are like, damn, that is powerful. You can say what you want about this guy, but that choice is awesome. I am really pumped. Like, I know it's not a huge thing. He's a white looking dude. Like, this is not the breakthrough we want. But as far as seeing names in spaces, it clearly meant a lot to a lot of people.
Yeah.
Real quick here in Standpoint, I just want to rip through a couple sources. Lieberman's book, Sports Heroines on Film, talks about how there's lots of different ways that women show up in sports movies. And the one that is at issue here is as kind of a part of like a ragtag crew. It's like she's going to be some kind of outsider who has to deal with her, the patriarchy, or she's going to be in a women's historical sport and she'll be given a little bit more credit, or she's going to be on a team with mostly other boys and the team itself will be characterized as a bunch of misfits. And she's not really characterized by being incapable. In fact, she's frequently better than a lot of the other boys. She's frequently smarter than a lot of the other boys. And so this is just your kind of classic tokenistic effort to put another like weirdo quote on a team of weirdos already, which further instantiates this idea that women maybe don't belong in sports. And the figure skating element could have had real creative implication here. And instead, it's like nothing.
Yeah, you could have had her skating up and down the ice and doing crazy moves. But instead, they just have one scene where she does like a quadruple axel and then knocks the puck in. And I'm like, come on, dude.
It's awful. It's so bad. It's so disappointing. And it's like, again, the idea is interesting and it just falls flat. So that book has lots to say on all sorts of different angles that we see women in sports. The Ostrov article, Disney Synergy in Anaheim, California, The Political Economy of the Mighty Ducks is 2015, The Political Economy of Communication. Synergy occurs when a company recirculates, recycles, repackages, and redeploys an intellectual property that it already owns. Disney literally put a hockey team into the world and a baseball team into the world.
Well, they bought into the baseball team, right?
Right. Well, this is the reason that they did that was so that they could recycle and regurgitate and recreate
a Tony Danza
everything.
Movie.
Yeah, exactly right. On 41 of this article by Ostrov, who I will point out is another Oregon Duck. Sco Ducks, the creation and sale of Disney's Mighty Ducks hockey team, a timeline. In 1992, the film is released. In 1993, they create the NHL team. I don't know many other movie studios that can do this. In 1994, they have the top-selling jersey in all of sports. In 1995, Disney buys ABC, including ESPN Sports Channel, and release the Mighty Ducks 2. By 2005, the Mighty Ducks are sold, but in 2002, the Mighty Ducks go to the Stanley Cup Finals.
Should be added too. Same year, the Angels go to the World Series as well. And then they sell them the very next year because they're done with the crossover thing at that point. Yeah.
Mission accomplished. They don't care. They're not here for sports. They're here for the Magic Kingdom and all that is Disney. And to literally, and as the article says, to put Anaheim as a city on a map so that their theme park will continue to have a sustainable base from which it can soak up a whole bunch of tourist dollars.
And also promote a movie that already came out and an entire franchise around it, clothing, action figures,
yeah,
and then have that content on ESPN. Like, I mean, when we talk about the synergy, let's just wrap this up in a bow and explain it. Like, all of these things fed all of these things, and you can see the threads very, very directly.
Yep. There's an article I sent you that I'm not going to say much more on besides the title, The Evolution of Product Placement in Hollywood Cinema, Embedding High Involvement Heroic Brand Images. This is Galician and Bordeaux, and this is from 2004. And basically, they look at the 15 top grossing motion pictures from 1977, 1987, and 1997. These are three decades, and they look at 15 movies from each decade. Just the lists alone are fascinating to look at. Kate and I found this with the Alien Movie Project. There's a lot of Alien movies on this list. But when it comes to product placement in this article, they talk about all the different kinds of like product placement and complementary copy and all of that. Complementary copy is when the brand drives the plot itself. The classic example is Ray-Bans in Men in Black. The Mighty Ducks are complementary copy on absolute steroids to the point that they literally are in the finals of a real hockey championship. It is incredible what Disney is able to accomplish.
One other note on like the whole commercial aspect of this, which doesn't so much tie into the synergy, but they have a newspaper at one point called Let's Play Hockey, America's number one hockey publication. And then super prominently on the bottom of the frame, it says the Coca-Cola Company. So they're definitely playing it from that aspect as well as like, hey, come in and you give us a little bit of money, you get perpetual advertising, right? They also show Greyhound and they make sure to like zoom in on the Greyhound symbol before they show the bus.
The fact that the bus doesn't change the plot makes Greyhound product placement. This article talks about the Glycine and Bordeaux article talks about how Coca-Cola is the brand par excellence for getting their name in the movies. I do have to make this nod. With National Velvet, we talked about one of my favorite tropes in all of movies when all the newspapers go... And this movie's doing it! This movie does it too! It makes me so happy! There it is. Okay, now, real briefly, we gotta talk about Survival of the Fattest, contending with the Fatboy in children's ensemble films. Jerry Mosher basically says in this book chapter that generations of cinema frame young fat men, in particular women too, to be dull, fretful, lazy, irritable, food obsessed, to have a whole lot of charisma sometimes, but also to be a caretaker, to be comic relief, to be humble, to be resilient. They can take a lot of damage. You can really beat up on them. They're going to be greedy. They're going to be corrupt. They're going to, I said, be lazy and dull in a different way. This is all part of them not being so innocent. It's always like their eating and their weight and their body is going to be a character judgment about the person themselves, and one of the only paths that they have forward is to be the comic relief. And we see this from like the Truffle Shuffle to you know, all sorts of like just big mouth goofy like fart sounds and things. You see this with like music getting ponderous and slow. It's just again and again and again, and it mentions this movie as one of the many that participates in this, and so I think it's worth bringing up here. Anti-fatness is devastating. The way that we talk about fatness, the word obesity is a slur. More people need to know that Deshaun Harrison has told us that the word obesity is a slur. We need to get better talking about fat folks and different bodies, and this is a good article to just examine the way that we tell these stories to children of an era.
And they don't have a ton of things that ping in this movie with that kid, but that kid is there solely just to be the fat kid. Like, make no mistake about it. He doesn't do anything else in this movie.
And there's little incidental moments. Like, they can fly by really quick, but if you are that kid in the theater and that is your avatar on the screen, you hear it loud and clear. And you understand that your place in that movie is contingent upon your ability to take that kind of treatment and to think of your body that way. And when you look at the politics of anti-fatness, this is a direct road to self-harm. This is awful, awful stuff. It's a fun movie and there's lots of silly little jokes, but it's participating in a whole bunch of, as we know it will, as all movies do, participating in a whole bunch of really devastating ideologies that we got to name out loud. And these folks have done it for us. Neat. How about excitement? Let's get there.
Damaged but determined District 5 Ducks dial up defense and defeat distinguished disputants in dazzling yet dire duel at dawn debacle. I'm so proud of that one.
It's so good. You texted it to me and I was trying this time. I was like drunk, disorderly, and then Biggs shows up with this and I'm like, all right, whatever. The alliteration is on point. Perhaps a little too alliterative? Never. No such thing.
You encouraged me last episode, so I had to.
And I will encourage you again. Further, farther, faster with the alliteration, Biggs. We can do it.
That's good alliteration there, Aaron. So one of the things I want to note in excitement is you're always trying to tie sports in with war, which I think we often do see the threads, but there is a direct one when that kid Fulton Reed is hitting the puck a couple of times. And definitely when the kid is attached to the goalposts and they're trying to get him so he's not afraid of the puck, you have bullet noises everywhere.
My mother would not approve of this, Coach. She'd like me to live to be bar mitzvahed.
This is your bar mitzvah, Goldberg. Today you will become a man.
District 5, ready!
Oh, man, I'm gonna die. I'm gonna die.
Hey!
Oh, guys, would you say something about this? Goldie. Oh, please, no!
Fire!
Not to mention you're putting together a squad, which is also something you have in either war movies or heist movies over and over again, right? Like, that's why he's out recruiting, is because, like, you're trying to find people to round out the team, right?
The reason I'm researching alien wars and sports is because of what they have to say about who belongs and who doesn't, and what the politics that we will enable when we create these kinds of worldviews. And this movie, as you say, is singing war rhetoric. Like, it is explicit, it is also fun, and it makes players men. One of the other notes I want to make that I've been looking at more and more and more is that you see very similar structural rising and falling in war movies and sports movies, where it's probably going to start with some kind of huge defeat or some kind of, like, down on their luck, like everything's lost. There's going to be a moment of bonding, of learning, of getting the unit in shape, putting the team together. We're going to go on a run. There's going to be like a string of potential victories, one huge setback, got to have the depths of Act Two, all is lost. And then we're going to have the big showdown at the end. And, you know, sports culture is a projection of war culture. This isn't rocket science. Everybody knows this. But the way that America tells itself that we are all soldiers and fighters, thus creating a whole culture of warriors, like, we don't even think of ourselves this way. Not in this movie, but that is what we are learning. And, you know, I think it's actually kind of a fun connection to my note on excitement. There's two things that I think, as far as movies making culture, people picking this stuff up and putting it in their lives, are concerned. And the one that I really want here is the flying V. I think Everyone loved the flying V. And as far as flying in formation is concerned, you can look at that and imagine bombers in the sky over Germany if you want. Like, this is what we're doing.
Like, they're invoking ducks, but it invokes more than ducks, right? And it's a unit working together in this formation that bombers do all the time.
And people are going to roll their eyes and think I'm just cross promoting. But if you go listen to the 12 o'clock high episode we have on the Real War Project, we talk about what it means to be one plane in a combat box, and you cannot leave. You cannot fall out. If your best friend dies, you will leave them behind, because the formation, the win, the battle is more important than any individual when we fly this way. And at the heart of it, it's a teamwork moment. And I love that. I love teamwork. I'm here for that. But when you make this war cut, it's explicit. And when we pick it up in our lives, as people did with this, that's meaningful.
Yeah. And I do want to say there's a lot of meat on those bones. We're not just bringing it up, but synergy is a thing that happens, as we've already talked about. And why not?
Yeah.
Disney can do it. So can Redwood Sound Labs.
For me, it's trying to pull the threads together to make the point. There's one more note on excitement that I have, and it is very simply quack, 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 quack. Quack. And I absolutely love this because, Biggs, I am a communication professor, and we talk about things like slogans and chants and how they hype people up. And again, we watched the documentary Born to Play. You should check it out, listener. It is amazing. It is such really a fascinating good. Story. Holy cow.
She was about four when she told us, when I grow up, I'm going to be a football player.
Being on the field just makes me feel alive. I feel that's where I'm supposed to be.
But
We have day jobs and we only get a couple days a week, a few hours at a time, exclusively on football. Boston is obsessed with sports. You know, those fan bases, the vast majority of them have no idea that we exist.
Last year, we are undefeated and we get to the championship game and we freaking lose.
Second place, like, that's nothing.
Time to finish.
And they've got their chance in that one. They count off their wins, and it's really awesome.
One, two, three, Boston! Five, six, seven, eight, nine.
Communication theory is overwhelming. It does not matter what you say. If you all believe in it, you will bond because of it. And quack, quack, quack is the funniest thing to say at a principal. It is the funniest thing in the world to say right before a game. And you know what? It does not matter. It works. Everyone gets pumped. Everyone wants to be part of it. I love it.
It's so catchy that I know that. And I quoted it last episode. I'd never seen Mighty Ducks.
Nope.
But I just heard it relentlessly. So, you know, it's definitely ingrained in the culture.
Yeah. A lot of my students, they're like, I don't care about movies. I don't watch movies. And I'm like, yeah, but you're surrounded by people that do. And movies that you've never seen come across your doorstep every day. And the question is, do you want to know about it or not?
Yeah.
You don't have to watch the movie, but you should at least be aware of the politics. It's cool how groups together chanting stuff can get fired up and feel connected. Obviously, this can lead us the wrong ways too, but just as a communication person, I dig it. I just want to listen to a quick couple seconds of music. In 1992, Kevin Costner starred as Robin Hood in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, and Michael Kamen wrote the soundtrack for that movie, and there's a little moment in that soundtrack that goes like this. And I love this song. It is absolutely amazing. And then I listened to the theme to the Mighty Ducks, came out the very next year, and it goes like this. And if you are me, that is way too similar. It can be faster, and all of the other little trills can be very, very different. But like, da-da-da-da-da, like that's there, and the dun-dun-dun-dun-dun, that's there. It's just a straight lift. It is an incredibly, like, almost verbatim lift of music. And we have talked about how people like, you know, James Horner will reuse his own content. Hans Zimmer will reuse his own content. This ain't that. David Newman is a totally different composer being like, I like that idea. Or it's just in his brain, like it's stuck in mine, and he put it in this movie. Not a meaningful note, but there it is, structural similarities. I will say that this little trumpet call to me sounds like a fox chase, and Charles and I talk about the trumpet and the hero horn and all of this, and there's a particular history there, so there's that note.
Fields of Glory will be back after a quick word from our sponsors. Okay, kiddo, I lost my library of sound, so I need you to do some sound effects for me.
I don't want to do this, Dad.
Look, I'm just trying to put food on the table, but if you don't want to help...
All right.
Hear Biggs chronicle a galaxy of genres. Listen to the deconstruction of film on A Cosmic Void. Charles is a Purple Heart recipient and cinematographer. Aaron is a professor and critical cultural scholar. Together they explore the narrative, effective, and production politics of war cinema on Real War Project. That's R-E-E-L, War Project. Finally, a podcast that's dedicated to talking about your favorite sports movies. Whether you want to hear a breakdown of the plot, arguments about who's the MVP of the film, or crit and lit about it, you'll find it all on Fields of Glory. Listen to the show that will help you have a better life with your beloved pets. It handles topics like proper food, nutrition, positive reinforcement training, and more. Certified dog behavior consultant Charlotte Peltz welcomes your pet concerns and questions in the podcast, Living with Your Dog. Zach and Matt are two horror enthusiasts of varying experience discussing horror movies through the scope of content, context, and comedy. They'll hit on the good ones and the classics, but they're really excited for the bad ones. Listen to Watch No Evil. You can find all of Redwood Sound Lab shows at Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, or wherever you listen to podcasts. MVP Aaron, who you got?
This one is so simple, Biggs, and you already pointed it out, not because of this movie, but because of intercollegiate speech and debate. I did go to the University of Oregon, and so I can tell you the MVP of this movie is the duck mascot. It is the single greatest mascot on earth. I adored being an Oregon duck. Sco ducks. We did not say quack, quack, quack. We said 60 ducks because my G's look like a six, and when I wrote go ducks, it said 60 ducks. I love it. That's my MVP. It is the duck mascot. What do you got?
So, Aaron, I'm an Xer, so I have to go with Fulton Reed. He looks like Parker Lewis can't lose character Larry Kubiak, dresses like Zach Della Rocca, and has no respect for the man's limousine windows. Plus, he hits a puck so hard that it levitates in the air at one quarter speed so that all the players know to dodge because its power will knock a hole through him.
They have the time to view it and get out of the way, but it goes through the net. Physics is like, these two things cannot happen.
With smoke. It goes through the net with smoke. Like it's a ridiculous. Razor cutting through it, dude.
I loved the puck cam. I thought it was so ridiculous that we get a puck cam. No, this is a good note. He is the power hitter. He makes the winning shot, doesn't he? He hits one for five.
Makes the winning shot. He makes the tying shot. Yeah,
that's right. He gets him into that shootout. It's a good pick. Sixth man, Biggs. What do you got?
Redistricting. This has to be the first time in my life that redistricting was framed for me in a positive way. That is, if you consider ripping a player away from his friends so that he can play for a team that never accepts him, only to be nearly killed by his friends. Way to go, redistricting.
Talk about a lawyer thing to do.
This is such a weird point in the movie, which I don't know. Everything else is a moral decision. I don't understand that decision, but whatever.
It's so funny. I'm sure we could spend a lot of time on what Banks is doing as a character. It's such a weird point. The sixth man for me was going to be lax DUI laws, because that is ultimately what brings the coach to the team. But based on what we said during the standpoint tip, the sixth man has to be synergy, Biggs. It's synergy. It's what puts it all together, man. It's what makes the whole thing work. And you don't see it on the field, but dang if it ain't making it happen.
The Billy Zabka Most Outstanding Villain Award. Who you got?
You first. This is what I say when I forgot to pick one.
The Hawks coach, Jack Riley. I wanted to like you because you were initially revealed in a blurry Vaseline-covered lens.
It's so blurry!
Also, you were in Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman, which gave me a badly needed fix of Supes and Terry Hatcher on the TV screen in the 90s.
It's a pretty good show.
But just like NRA board director Dean Cain, you've disappointed me. How can you badger one of your athletes because he missed a shot? And how could you rattle him when he lost his father? And how could you continue to bother him when he's an adult? How could you make sure that one of your child athletes who you've constantly stalked like De Niro in The Fan gets fired from his job? Plus, you have kids take out other kids, and one of them was your athlete, and a kid who will probably lose his father and his job when you manipulate his career from your retirement home. You suck, Jack Riley.
It's not looking good for Jack Riley here. It's pretty bad. But I found someone worse, Biggs. I have found the true Billy Zabka Most Outstanding Villain probably of all time, and it is the Walt Disney Corporation. How can they pick on large children like this? How can they pick on girls like this? How can they pick this kind of hero and say that this is a story that we all need to be told, that sometimes the drunk driving lawyer ain't so bad, he just needs to be given a chance to coach a hockey team, and you'll understand that deep down he's just a hurt little boy. No, I don't buy it. Disney, as Giroux says, you have monopolized childhood for profit. It's not good. Villainous behavior, in my opinion. Yeah.
Black Monday. Emilio, you took over the team because the court ordered you to do it because of a DUI. So we weren't expecting the cream of the crop, but you drove your limo on the ice, risking all the children. You shoved them down immediately after meeting them because he's blocking your view of the limo. We don't have to get your coaching philosophy from here on out, because you need to serve your prison sentence after day one of your community service. Get out of here.
Yeah, you have been found guilty of a DUI, or at least pled guilty to a DUI. I think that's what happens if you're taking that community service. You ain't coaching my my team. Why are we having this conversation now? That's my question. This should have been like a Black Thursday or a Black Friday conversation as soon as the dude, as you said, we're not expecting the cream of the crop. We're probably turning you back at the door if we're in charge of this team for sure. Well, thank you for listening. The show was researched, written, hosted, and produced by Aaron Donaldson and Alex Small. You can check out our Letterboxd account under Alex Biggs Small or under AP Donaldson.
We'll return next week with our block on hustling with, well, the hustler. But coming up next, Jessica Fletcher returns to her hometown of Sussex to find her sister has been killed in the Grand National Steeplechase. But when she sees the trainer whistling down the road, she suspects foul play. Murder, she wrote. Coming up next.
It's amazing.
How about it? Who's a duck? I'll be a duck.